Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Regular listeners of this podcast are probably aware that the majority of topics we cover on the show happen to fall into the realm of American Christianity. Yes, we've had interviews focusing on China, Russia, a few other countries, and some other religious traditions, including Judaism, Islam, and Eastern religions. But for the most part, I've been sticking on topics pretty close to home. Well, today we pick up our spice weasel, knock it up a notch, and go global, not only in terms of our topic, but in terms of our guest. Our topic will be about church-state regimes around the world, whether they have supportive, neutral, or hostile governments, and what that means for religious practitioners. But not only that, today's show marks the first time that we've had a guest from outside the continental United States. Now, a few weeks back, we had Robert Woodbury, who's at the National University in Singapore, but he actually was in Texas when we did the interview. My guest today is Professor Jonathan Fox, a professor of political science at Bar Ilan University in Israel. He is the project founder and coordinator of the Religion and State Project, which is a large research effort funded by the John Templeton Foundation to study the intersection of religion and politics around the world. That project is also linked with the Association of Religious Data Archives, of whom we also share an informal relationship with. He has published a number of books, including A World Survey of Religion and the State, Religion, Politics, Society, and the State, Bringing Religion into International Relations, Religion, Civilization, and Civil War, 1945 through the New Millennia, and a new textbook coming out in October called An Introduction to Religion and Politics, Theory and Practice. We will post links to all these books as per our usual procedure, so mosey on over to our website and click on those links. Jonathan has also authored or co-authored over 70 articles on various topics related to religion, religion and state, and ethnic conflict, as well as working on two or three other book manuscripts at the moment. He actually writes faster than I can read, and when it comes to picking a specific topic for today's interview, I was inundated by the amount of scholarship he sent my way, so I thought we'd keep our discussion fairly broad today. I should finally note that he also teaches a class in politics and science fiction at Bar Ilan University, which is somewhat intriguing. Jonathan joins us today via the magic of Skype, which is also another first for this podcast, and we'll see how that goes. Jonathan, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you very much, but actually I just called you on a normal phone line. Skype is not so reliable international.
Okay, so I'll just have to go back and say, hey, we are not doing this on Skype. We'll have to do it some other point in time, but the reception is coming in good. And what time is it in Israel out there now?
About 8:30 in the morning.
Okay, so for me, it's 10:30 at night here, so I'm getting a little bit sleepy and tired and ready to go to bed, but you're just starting out your day, so this will be an interesting dynamic that we have going here.
We get that a lot here.
Say what?
We get that a lot.
You get that a lot because of, the different times and different sequence if you're dealing with scholars from the United States and stuff. Hey, but before we get into this religion and state stuff, I got a quick question regarding your interest in science fiction. And I share your interest in science fiction, and that was especially true when I was growing up as a kid and as a teenager, though I wouldn't consider myself a Trekkie or Star Wars geek. But I have to ask you this, is what is your favorite all-time science fiction movie?
It's probably got to be Blade Runner.
Oh, yeah. That's a dystopian view of the world, huh?
Yeah. Honestly, I like science fiction literature much more than I like the movies. I just think you can do more in a good book than you can in a movie.
Oh, so what's your favorite book then?
Oh, God, I don't think I could pick one. I like so many.
Okay. And how were you able to get a class on that at Bar-Ilan University? Just did they say, hey, teach something that you're really interested in, and that's okay?
Well, what actually happened was is there was a mix-up in the scheduling, and at the last minute they had to add a class that I could teach almost with no prep time, and I managed to con them into it.
Okay. All right. Well, that's pretty cool. I have to admit, my favorite science fiction movie of all time is Die Hard. Yeah. So I know people don't say it's a science fiction, but I think Die Hard actually encapsulates all the great movie genres of all time, your romantic movies and science fiction, your classic historical biographies, as well as being probably the greatest Christmas movie ever made. So that's my opinion stuff.
A lot of people have different ideas of what science fiction. Like what I think is a particularly good science fiction novel that most people don't think about is one is Mark Twain's A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court.
Oh, because it's got time travel.
A man with knowledge of electricity, yeah. Modern political philosophy, gunpowder, modern warfare, dropped over 1,000 years earlier in time. That's science fiction.
That is true. That's actually a pretty interesting observation. I never thought about that before. Well, we're going to have to get you back on another time to talk about science fiction and politics, but we have to get down to talking about this religion and state project that you've been working on for, I guess, a little bit more than a decade now. And I got to, first of all, thank you for doing this, because for us social scientists, you've really performed an amazing task of gathering data from virtually every country in the world regarding how each nation interacts with religious organizations and religious believers. Give us an idea how this religion and state project got started and what it all encompasses.
I did my graduate work at University of Maryland with Ted Gurr, who's also a well-known data collector on other topics. And I've always been interested in religion. And at the time, he was working on ethnic conflict. I managed to add a religious twist to that in my dissertation, but was just not really completely satisfied because it only let me collect or test actually very specific things having to do with ethnic conflict. And I wanted to look at something more general. And that sort of involved to the kernel of the idea for this project. I developed the idea for what I wanted to do as I was grant writing. As you know, these things can be very expensive, and you have to look for money, and the project pretty much evolved out of that.
Mm-hmm. Now, how many people got working on this project? Is it just you, or have you been rolling other people into this project over the past decade?
Over the past decade, a lot of people have been involved. When we're actually collecting the data, and I hope your listeners aren't too bored by words like data collection, I have a number of researchers working for me, mostly students, could be between 3 and 5 at any given time. Over the course of the project, I've had at least 20 people working for me, probably about maybe as many as 25 or 30. I'd have to sit there and count the names. And once you have the information, I do most of the work analyzing it, but I've certainly involved other colleagues, probably most notably Yasmin Akbaba, who is currently at Gettysburg College, who's done a lot of work with me on looking at the minority religions. Lately, also, I've been working a lot with Annie Sarkissian, who's at Michigan State. And I'm also starting up a project looking at using my data combined with some stuff other people are collecting at the University of Hamburg to examine the impact of religion on civil wars.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of getting the funding for this, was it pretty easy finding funding for this? The Templeton Foundation is out there, but you got to convince these folks of what you're doing is a pretty worthy objective, right?
Well, I've had funders other than the Templeton Project. My startup actually was funded by the Israel Science Foundation, which is the Israeli version of the NSF. The Templeton grant was actually quite interesting. It was part of a much larger grant for a several million dollar grant for ARDA, run by Roger Finke out of Penn State. And he pretty much sent me an email saying, "We're looking to fund data collection. Would you like some money?" And I said, yes, I would, and it pretty much proceeded from there.
Yeah, very cool. That I was going to ask if you have that connection with the Association for Religious Data Archives, or ARDA, with Roger Finke, who's been on this program before, because it is an incredible resource, not only for scholars, but it's an incredible resource for anybody in the general public. And we'll post a link to this on our website, because you can just go there and learn stuff fairly easily just by clicking buttons. And I think it connects to a lot of the data that you've collected. So you say, hey, I want to find out what's going on, what the religious landscape is like in Paraguay. A few clicks of the mouse, and you can find that stuff out. It's pretty cool.
A large portion of the data they have online is actually stuff I've collected. We've been cooperating a lot. The latest thing we actually have is I've collected information on the religion clauses and the constitutions of the world, and that's pretty much online. You can click there and see what every country's constitution has to say about religion, and that's stuff I pretty much got together myself, pretty much going through the world's constitutions, constitution by constitution.
Yeah.
Not a pleasant task.
No, it's not, but I'm glad somebody did it, and I'm glad it was not me. You know, so it's somebody has to do some of that work, but you've really leveraged it well and produced a lot of great scholarship on that kind of stuff. And so that's the stuff we want to talk about here. Now, I should note here that one of the main things, your project is called the Religion and State Project. I always have a tendency to talk about church-state relations, since I mostly focus on Christian nations, and those Christians usually call their stuff churches. But you're focusing on a lot of different religions all around the world. That includes Judaism, Islam, Buddhism, you name it. And those institutions always don't call themselves churches. So you use the term religion and state, I think, more appropriately. But I'm going to apologize ahead of time if I slip into my old format of saying church-state relations here. So, hey, one of the things that the Religion and State Project has done has been, as you mentioned, to create this measurement of state religious policy around the world, and it's really advanced our empirical knowledge on religion-state relations, since most of the previous studies that were conducted before, you know, you came into this process, was to focus on the concepts of just religious freedom. And it was oftentimes seen as this either or category. You either had religious freedom or you didn't. And that is not really the case of what this thing is. So you, in your data collection, provide an actually more nuanced version of that concept. So what do you mean when you talk about religious liberty or religious freedom? What are you measuring there?
The question of religious liberty and religious freedom, I don't really distinguish between the terms, but a lot of people do. But what it basically comes down to when people are talking about religious liberty and religious freedom is they're more often talking about what states ought to do rather than what states actually do. And I tend to focus more on what they actually do, which makes things a little easier. But if you're going to go on to the issue of what states ought to do, terms like religious freedom and religious liberty mean different things to different people. In fact, a lot of times I found when people are arguing about religious freedom in a particular country, it turns out they're not arguing about what's going on in the country. They're arguing about what they mean by religious liberty or religious freedom. And I really think there are two things that people are talking about. One of them is the question of, do people have the ability to practice their religion freely? And the truth is, in most countries, they don't. In fact, in no country can people have complete religious freedom. Take, for example, a religion from my part of the world, which has been extinct for some time, the sect of the Bao. Now, in this religion, it was basically, they had an idol that was called the Bao. It was made out of some sort of metal. I believe it was bronze. And it had a furnace inside. And they would light it up. The metal would get red hot. It had hands cupped out in front of it, and people would toss their firstborn children into the hands of the Bao, and the children would be burnt to cinders, and this was part of their worship of the Bao. I don't imagine there's a country in the world that would allow people to do this, because murder trumps religious freedom. Religion doesn't provide an excuse for you to engage in murder. More contemporary examples. Some friends of mine in California have told me that there's been some unpleasantness over the years there because the Wiccans, who have a religion where they worship nature, sometimes through various deities, sometimes not, depending on the sect, and part of their ceremonies involve dancing naked out in nature, which means they want to start dancing naked in the public parks, and there are public decency ordinances which that violates, and that has caused a certain amount of tension.
Yeah, that's a little bit surprising that there are those ordinances in California that you can't dance naked in the parks, but apparently they still do exist.
Yeah, apparently it is still there, and it is still at least occasionally enforced. These are just two examples, one more extreme than the other, that religion can't be an excuse to do absolutely anything you want to do. So in that sense, every country in the world restricts religious freedom. But even if we're going to avoid this type of example with something extreme like a child sacrifice or public nudity ordinances, which you can pretty much find everywhere in the world, more than four in five countries of the states in the world engage in at least some substantial restrictions on religious liberty in the way most of us would consider it. Like, say, for instance, making it difficult or impossible for a religious group to build a church, a mosque, a synagogue, or whatever they happen to call their place of worship. Restrictions on the ability to import important religious texts, such as the Bible or the Quran. These things are actually quite common, and less than one in five countries in the world do not restrict that at all.
Mm-hmm. That's an amazingly low percentage, just 20%. We're going to break that down a little bit in terms of, mm-hmm. of regions here in a second. But, I mean, you're making a very good point.
And I'd like to note, democracies do a little better than only one in five, but it's I'd have to double-check the numbers, but as I recall, it's not much better than one in three that have complete freedom in that respect, even among Western democracies. These restrictions on religious minorities are quite rampant across the world.
Yeah, you make some good points here. In part, what you're saying here is that religious freedom is not just this on-off button where you can turn it on and off. There's a matter of degree here, and that at some point, there are these natural barriers that you run up against that you have to say, you know, no, you can't have your murdering cult running around killing people. So the state is going to have to step in. So there's always going to be some kind of limits there. And the question becomes, it's a matter of degree. And what you have been doing, not only looking at constitutional decrees, but also looking at how churches actually practice this stuff at the local level, really brings out how governments can restrict religions. Now, one of the things that you bring up, and I think this is a very important aspect of it when we're talking about religious freedom and religious equality and trying to figure out how states measure up in this, is the issue of how governments treat religions equally. That's an important aspect of what you're talking about here, too, right?
Yes, that's actually the second aspect of what a lot of people consider religious freedom. So let's just say, for example, we're in a country where minorities can practice their religion freely. There are no substantial restrictions on their religion as long as they avoid things like human sacrifice and dancing naked in the park. Mm-hmm. But let's say in this state, the state says, well, there's one religion or perhaps some religions that we prefer, and we're going to support that religion in a whole number of ways, say perhaps financially. We're going to fund it. We're going to make sure the state holidays are the same holidays as that of the religion. Well, minority religions might go and say, that's not fair. We do not have a level playing field. The religions that the state are supporting have an unfair advantage. Their members don't have to pay the same membership fees in order to support the congregation because religion costs money. You have a building, the building costs money. You have a clergy, the clergy collect salaries, so on and so forth. Religion costs money. It is not free. Now, if the state is paying for it, that means me, for example, when I was living in America, I'm Jewish, and if America happened to support Christianity, which it doesn't financially to any substantial sense, but let's say it did, my taxes would be going to support whatever Christian church America might have chosen to support. And if I want to go to synagogue, I have to pay out of my own pocket. That's not fair. It makes it more expensive for me to be Jewish than it would be for somebody to be Christian. And that would arguably allow Christianity to thrive more easily than Judaism. The situation I've described is not the situation in the U.S., but it is the situation in almost all of Western Europe, with a few exceptions. This is actually the norm for a Western democracy to support one religion or a number of religions more than others. And a lot of people feel that that is not religious liberty, because religious liberty or religious freedom includes equality, because without this equality, certain religions have an advantage over others.
Yeah, and that's a great point. I make this with my students as well when I teach my religion and politics class, because you know, some students say, well, you know, yeah, the government collects taxes for a certain denomination, but you know what? Everybody else is free to practice as they want. And you know, looking at this at the micro level, if I'm a person who is, let's say, a Christian, there's one denomination that's favored over another, and those denominations are pretty similar. There might be some doctrinal differences that theologians argue about, but, you know, from my standing on the ground level, they look pretty similar. And I'm saying, wait a minute, my taxes are already going to this one church. So if I went to this other church, I'd have to pay them again. That's like having to go twice, right? Or having to pay twice. And, you know what, I'll just kind of stick with that other one. So that really does disadvantage that minority religion that's not on that equal playing field.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's more common than you would think. By my count, half of Western democracies support one religion more than another. About 30% have official religions. Countries you've heard of, like Denmark, Finland, Greece, Iceland, Norway, England, they have official religions. The state designates a religion as official religion, and they support that religion. Others have sort of an unofficial official religion. They don't actually declare an official religion, but one religion is clearly favored. Countries, you actually find this more in Catholic countries like Ireland, Italy, Portugal, and Spain. Then most of the rest of Western countries, they will actually support some religions, but not others. Also countries you've heard of, like Austria, Belgium, Germany, Sweden, which, by the way, had an official religion until 2000, but they decided to get rid of, and Switzerland. Less than one in four Western countries actually do not have some sort of regime where some religions are supported more than others. So the U.S. is very much in the minority in that one.
And a lot of people don't really recognize that. They see Europe as being a very secular part of the world, and they figured, well, you know, they must have lots of religious freedom. One of the other issues that comes up oftentimes in these debates about religious liberty is this issue of separation of religion and state. And you correctly point out that these things are not the same. And you go ahead in the works, that various books that you've written here, you've provided a categorization of state religion policy that helps to differentiate these various ways that governments regulate and manage these religions. So let's go through that. And I just kind of, if you could, start off by telling us, what's the difference between separation of church and state and religious liberty? Why aren't those two things the same?
Well, religious, again, both concepts, to a large extent, depend on how you define them. Now, for instance, I already discussed that there are two possible meanings in the larger sense of what does freedom of religion mean, but separation of religion and state also does not mean the same thing to different people, and you can divide the models for separation of religion and state into three categories. One is something we call the separationist model, which is basically the model the U.S. follows, which is the government is not allowed to interfere in religion, is not allowed to support religion. Basically, the U.S. government, for example, just stays out of religion, doesn't help it, doesn't hinder it. That's the separationist model. That's actually one of the less common models out there. More common model is the neutrality model. Now, this model means that the state can get involved in religion. It can support it, and it can restrict it, but it has to treat all religions equally. This goes back to the level playing field argument. For example, if a government wants to say, I don't want anybody to be allowed to engage in religious hate speech, you may not insult anybody's religion, well, this would not violate this model as long as you go ahead and say that applies to all religions. In the U.S., you wouldn't be allowed to insult Christianity, but you would not be allowed to insult Judaism, Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, and any other religion that might exist in the U.S. Mm-hmm. This is different from, say, a blasphemy law you might find in other countries where only the majority religion is protected.
Now, that's got to be a pretty difficult tightrope to walk because, you know, as soon as you try to say, well, we're going to be neutral to all religions, there's almost a tendency for people to start creating or declaring other types of religion, for instance, Scientology, right? I know the Netherlands have this model where they try to basically be neutral across all religions, but then you get something that comes in like Scientology and somebody says, well, you know, I don't know if that's a religion. So the government has to first define what is a religion, what is not a religion, before it can actually start playing this neutral playing field.
Yeah, that does get very difficult. But if you want to have more fun with this, you can get to the Cult of the Great Spaghetti Monster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you're familiar with that.
Yeah.
Now, as I understand it, nobody actually believes in this religion, but in the U.S. it was set up as an actual religion and is recognized as a religion. And the purpose of it was to basically demonstrate that, well, if you want to include religious teachings in public schools, we can set up a religion that says anything and demand equal time. Are you familiar with the Cult of the Great Spaghetti Monster?
I do, and we'll link to it on our website. So it was one of these things that...
I love their website. These people have a very serious sense of humor.
Yeah, no, it is very enjoyable. And it makes a very interesting point, too, of that, you know, you just can't say, well, we're neutral between all religions. At some point in time, the government has to recognize what is a religion, what is not. Even here in the United States, where we say, well, we don't like to get involved in that kind of thing. For tax purposes, if you're going to run a tax-exempt church... Well, I would like to declare myself a church, and then, you know, I won't have to pay taxes. But government's going to say, no, you don't fall into our criteria of what makes a church. So that definitional issue becomes rather important here, even in the neutrality model. Now, you mentioned there's a separationist model, there's a neutrality model, and you said there was a third one?
Yes, the third model is the laicism model, or laïcité, if you're going to use the French pronunciation, which I'm probably mangling badly, but this has a different attitude towards religion. This model considers religion a private issue that really has no place in the public sphere, and thus the government not only does the government not get involved in religion, it will often restrict religion in the public sphere. But whatever is done in private, behind closed doors, in churches or synagogues or mosques or whatever you would like to call your place of worship, that's okay, but we would not like religion to intrude in the public sphere. And France made this very explicit in 2004 when they passed a law banning the wearing of any overt religious symbol in public schools. This was instigated by their growing Muslim population, which is becoming more religious, and the women would come to school with the traditional Muslim head covering. And the French did not like this, not in particular, I don't think, because the symbol was Muslim. They just did not want any religious symbol in the public schools. And that's why when they passed the law, they were very explicit that it would cover any religious symbol. A Jew cannot wear a yarmulke on the public school, and a Christian may not wear a ostentatious cross outside his clothing. Mm-hmm. You want to keep a cross under your shirt? They have no problem with that because that's already private space.
So those are the three models of the separation of church and state, separationist neutrality model, and then there is the laïcité model, as I think they say it in French. French, mm-hmm. I'm probably mangling that as well, too. But then again, you know, we were talking about some of these governments or states that actually endorse certain religions, that there are official state religions like in the United Kingdom or in Denmark or in Greece or in Iceland. And then there's also these ones that get unofficial support like in Ireland or Italy, Portugal, and Spain that you mentioned here. One of the questions I have always had that when a government steps in, and I guess this is from my perspective here in the United States, this all seems foreign to me, is that when you have a government that supports a religion or endorses a religion, do you think that has any impact on the population? You say, oh, the Queen of England has rattled her jewelries and she says that the Church of England is the official church. And I say, well, I was trying to figure out what church to go to, but the Queen says that one, so I must believe that that's a good one. Or do you think people are maybe a little bit more cynical or see through that kind of endorsement stuff?
Okay, well, that's something that I don't get into as much in my research, but there's been a huge amount of research on that among sociologists, and the sociologists are debating that very hotly. A lot of people basically argue that, as you would expect, the more the government supports religion, the more likely the population is to be religious. Mm-hmm. But a lot of sociologists have been for, I guess, about two decades now arguing the opposite. And there are a bunch of names for this body of theory, but I tend to use the phrase supply-side theory, which I know you're very familiar with. And it's basically the argument that when you have a religious monopoly that creates a religious market that is less free, and we have a less free religious market, you have less people who are religious for a number of reasons. One reason would be is when you have a less free market, there are less religious providers, less religions to choose from, so people are less likely to find a religion that they would like. So they may just simply stay home because there's no church that they like to go to, if we're talking about Europe. In addition, once the government is supporting religion, the salary of the clergy is more dependent on support within the government and other political factors. So the clergy is going to focus more on dealing with government bureaucracy and satisfying the government than satisfying their congregation, which also would make church less popular. And then there's the general attitude that people don't like the government telling them what to do, and if the government is telling them to be religious, that's going to create a certain amount of backlash. Like I said, this issue is hotly debated among sociologists, and there's nobody really agrees on exactly what the correct answer is to this question.
Yeah, it is. It's something that comes up with me all the time in relations with this issue of separation of church and state, because I know a number of Europeans have come over here to the United States, and they've told me, oh, we have such separation of religion and politics in Europe, and nobody gets involved in that. But here, you know, in the United States, you think you're all separation of church and state, but religion's highly involved in it. I always tell them, I said, listen, you really don't have a lot of separation of religion and politics so much, because you do have these state-endorsed churches or state-funded churches. And I also tell my atheist friends that if they ever want to basically limit the amount of religion that they have in society, you know, follow up the European model. Don't try to separate church and state. Make religion a subsidiary of the government, and that will just basically ensure that people stop going to church like in Europe. So, yeah, interesting argument there.
While you're at it, I think it's important to distinguish between separation of religion and state, mm-hmm. and separation of religion and politics.
Yes.
Politics involves things more than the government. Take the U.S. example. The government in the U.S. does a relatively good job of staying out of religion. I know a number of my American colleagues disagree with me on this one, but when you compare what happens in the U.S. to everywhere else in the world, the U.S. actually does quite well in this respect.
Mm-hmm.
But religion and politics is something else. So we're talking about the use of religious language and terms and imagery in political discourse. Well, that's pretty much open season in the U.S., and it's actually, to some extent, expected of politicians, and you'll see that much less in Europe. They're really talking about two different things. One is government policy, and the other is how much does the political culture allow people to bring up religion. And those are two completely different issues, although they are related.
That's actually a very good point. In fact, it is an interesting dynamic to observe that while there is not much separation of church and state in the institutional sense of the term in Europe, you don't have much religion involved in politics, such as campaigning, pushing for certain public policies, the dialogue that politicians use. But here in the United States, where you do have that separation, where church and state are separate, all of a sudden religions become a way to mobilize political action, which is a rather interesting phenomenon to observe.
Well, actually, you have more religious involvement in politics in Europe than you would think, but it's more often the institutions themselves lobbying on specific laws, especially topics like abortion.
Mm-hmm. So almost it's the institutions doing it, not necessarily public mobilization.
There is some public mobilization, but I think it's more institution-driven than it is in the U.S.
One of the things I want to talk to you about is this issue of regulating religions and how governments actually do this. And you, when you talk about this in your writing, you talk about the regulation of all religions. Why is the issue of all important here? What does all regulating all religions include?
When a government regulates religion, it has to decide which religions it's going to regulate. And it means something very different if the government says we're placing limitations only on certain religions, usually just minority religions, not necessarily all of them, perhaps some of them, or it's regulating all religion in the country, including the majority religion. Now, this has a very important philosophical distinction, because if the government regulates all religion in the same way, including the majority religion, if we're going to use the neutral model for religious freedom, the neutral model for separation of religion and state, well, then that's perfectly okay. But if you're going to regulate only some religions and not others, that's not equal treatment. So it has an important philosophical distinction. It also has a very practical distinction, because when you're regulating only some religions, usually, again, when governments regulate some religions, it's almost always they're regulating minority religions and not the majority religion.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, if you're limiting minority religions and leaving the majority religion alone, that's a form of preference for the majority religion. In a zero-sum game where all religions are competing for congregants, if you restrict some religions, those that aren't restricted have an advantage. If you regulate all religion, this means the state has an attitude that this is something we just don't want going on in the state and we don't care who's doing it, we're not going to allow it.
Mm-hmm.
A common one, for example, is quite a large number of countries restrict the use of religion in politics. There are laws in numerous states saying that political parties may not be affiliated with religion, they may not use religious imagery or rhetoric when they're engaging in political campaigns. Clergy may not discuss political issues is another common one. Clergy may not run for office is another common one. And again, this isn't necessarily saying religion is a bad thing, but it is the government saying we don't want religion getting heavily involved in politics.
And that can be applied across the board to all religions. But what about restrictions on religious minorities? I know when you look at the constitutions of most states all around the world, everybody has this clause that say everybody's free to practice their religion, yada, yada, yada. It works out great. So if you just looked at the constitutional declarations, everybody seems to have lots of religious freedom and minorities are protected. Great. But actually, how does this stuff actually play out in reality? Like you said, you're out there with your religion and state project actually measuring what states do. And how do states actually regulate religious minorities in ways that is disadvantageous to them?
Okay, well, the first thing you have to understand is a clause in a constitution promising religious freedom or banning this religious discrimination is very common. Over 9 in 10 constitutions have something in them along those lines. And of those countries that have a religious freedom clause in their constitution, 4 in 5 clearly do not observe it. It's one of the, in fact, I'm going to avoid technical statistical language, but I did some a serious battery of tests, and the connection between what's written in the Constitution and what happens on the ground is almost close to zero as far as religious freedom is concerned.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. 4 and 5, that's 80% of all constitutional declarations by states are somehow voided by their own states in practice.
It's actually 81%.
Okay, yes. Well, higher than 80%. Oh, my gosh.
And a lot of constitutions, if you actually read their clauses, they go ahead and say, there is religious freedom, but either they have some sort of exception. For instance, the government provides religious freedom. However, religious freedom may not be, does not trump things like public safety or the common good, public morals or customs, national security or defense. When you start sticking exceptions in there like that, you can pretty much justify whatever you want.
Yeah, you're going to have all these definitions of what is public morals and what constitutes national security, et cetera, et cetera.
The more interesting thing is in countries like the U.S., where the religious freedom portion of the U.S. Constitution is relatively brief and has no exceptions, these exceptions tend to crop up in the case law as defined by the courts.
Instead of by a bureaucracy or a ministry of the religion or something.
Exactly.
Yeah. Could you give us some examples of how states creatively, even though they say they have religious freedom in their constitutions, how they creatively stomp on the rights of religious minorities around the world?
Well, in a lot of cases, they aren't really all that creative about it. They just pretty much ignore it. And the question is whether you have a court system that's effective enough to stop the government from doing it. Autocratic governments, for example, they have very pretty constitutions that have all sorts of interesting rights, but it's pretty much for show. It doesn't really mean anything. Back in the day, people used to say that the Soviet Union had a wonderfully democratic and liberal constitution, but everybody knows it didn't really mean anything.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first issue. The second issue is, assuming you have a court system that's capable of restricting government behavior, how far are they going to take it? It's common for courts to balance various constitutional precepts against each other. So you go to court and you have religious freedom on one hand, but you also have a clause in the Constitution that bans any language involving religious hatred. Well, what does religious hatred mean? If, say, for instance, a court could say anybody going out and saying that if anybody does not accept Jesus Christ as their personal savior, they're going to hell. Now, that's a basic tentative belief among many Christians, possibly most. It's not something I've actually examined, although I imagine there are polls that will tell you what percentage of Americans believe that.
Mm-hmm.
There are countries where if you go ahead and say that in public, you have violated their religious hatred laws. So it's less about being creative and more, in many cases, and more about balancing precepts. But if you want to go into creative stuff, for instance, let's say you want to build a Baptist church in a number of countries in Europe. Interestingly enough, the Baptists have had a lot of difficulties in a number of countries in Europe doing just that. There's no law saying they can't build a church, but somehow they never seem to manage to get a building permit. There are various zoning regulations causing them problems, so on and so forth, and the church does not get built. Same happens to mosques, and same happens to, well, it's actually in Europe, it's mostly mosques and churches from religions that are new to the particular country that have this kind of trouble. Other religions like Hinduism and Buddhism seem to have less trouble.
Yeah, and that's always fascinated me. I've worked a lot in Latin America in the early part of my career, and I come across a number of these very creative ways that the Latin American governments have restricted Protestant minorities from coming in. And these included things. I remember there was some ordinance in Chile that you were not allowed to play a tambourine or have a tambourine parade in the streets on Sunday morning. And ostensibly it was so that you wouldn't upset public peace and annoy people with the tambourine playing, because Pentecostals would oftentimes walk through neighborhoods before their church services, and they would sing and they'd play tambourines, and you know, people would come out of their houses and say, oh, what are they doing? There's nothing else to do here Sunday morning. This looks pretty interesting. Let's follow these people. They go off to their church, and all of a sudden they get more congregations. So, you know, some of these ordinances were very clearly directed at Pentecostals, even though it had this ostensible creative way of saying, no, this is all just about the public peace and things like that.
That would be an interesting example of religious discrimination. The question I would ask when I'm looking at something like that, well, in the same town, do they restrict the hours the churches can ring their bells? If they're applying noise ordinances to everybody equally, whether you're a church ringing your bell, a Pentecostal dancing around in the street with the tambourine, or Muslim turning on the loudspeakers for the call to prayer, if it applies to everybody equally, at least that would fit the neutral model.
Right.
If it applies only, if they write it in a way that it applies only to specific religions, then you have something else.
Yeah, and that's one of these big issues that's been coming up in Europe. I know in Switzerland they had a big issue over minarets on mosques, and it had to deal with the size of the minarets and how it fit into the actual size of buildings around the town, and you know, that, so that becomes an issue. But there's also the issue of a call for prayers, and they say, well, no, if you have call for prayers, that becomes a nuisance. And you know, a lot of Muslims just turn around and point and say, hey, at noon the bells of the church go off all the time. Well, how is that any different, right?
Pretty much, although you'll be interested to know there are a number of Muslim countries that limit how loud these calls to prayers might be also. So this is not something unique to Christian countries.
No, this is that we've been focusing mostly on the United States and Europe here, but this, you know, what you do in your data set and looking at all, what, 190 plus some countries in the world, is pretty amazing. This stuff occurs all over the place.
Actually, I have 177 currently.
177 countries. I thought there were 190 countries. Have you lost some?
Well, there are a lot of countries that are basically small islands in the Pacific with a few thousand people living on them that I don't include. I use a population cutoff of 250,000 people. If you have less than that, I probably don't include you.
Oh, see, those are the countries that you got to go study because they got the really nice beaches and you can sit there sipping drinks during sunset and stuff. That's where research got to be taken.
If I had the funding for field research, we'd definitely be talking about that.
Okay. I want to switch gears here in terms of what we're talking about here. We've mostly been talking about how states regulate religions and how they define the terms on which different religions play. But you also do a lot of work that has to deal with reversing that causal path, is that how religions influence politics as well, how either religious belief or religious institutions affect politics and public policies. And here in the United States, there's basically this cottage industry on studying how the Christian right has become the, I would guess, the puppet masters of the Republican Party, even though there's a lot of other pathways that religious groups influence the dialogue with here in the United States. I want to get your take on how religion influences politics around the world. And you lay this out in three categories in your forthcoming textbook. You talk about worldviews and beliefs, religious legitimacy, and religious institutions. So let's kind of take those one by one here and start with worldviews and beliefs. And this is what most people tend to think about when you get back to the old Weberian Protestant ethic thesis. What are you talking about when you say religion and politics, worldviews and beliefs?
Well, worldviews and beliefs are something everybody has. We can't really function in the world without some sort of belief framework to explain to us basic things like what is happening, why is it happening, and what should we do about it. When two people with different belief systems look at the same thing, they can actually see it very differently, and it'll have very different political implications. And I'll give you a very large meta-historical example of how many Western Christians view history as opposed to how many Muslims view history. And I just want to say I'm not generalizing to all Christians and Muslims. I'm just talking about views that are prevalent within each of those religious societies. Mm-hmm. So it political science, we always end up going back to 1648 and the Treaty of Westphalia, which is a very boring topic to students, but it's very important because that treaty pretty much established how the Western world deals with politics. In this particular case, for our purposes, it's important because it ended one of the nastiest religious wars in Europe, the 30 Years' War in the States, basically said we had enough of religion and we're going to keep religion out of international relations. It's going to be an issue that is part of a state's sovereignty and we're just not going to address it anymore in international relations. So suddenly the relations between states, at least from a European perspective, no longer involves religion. About 35 years later, in 1683, the Ottomans, who had been advancing across Europe with the intent of imposing Islam in the entire world, they were very clear about that, were defeated at the gates of Vienna. And from that point in time, in the various battles between the Muslim world and the Christian world, the Christians spent several centuries winning. So we'll get to the specifics of that, but basically from that point on, the Europeans were living in a world which for them, religion was not part of international politics, and it was growing less important in domestic politics. There was no major religious threat. The threat of the Ottoman Muslims attacking Europe was receding. And the Enlightenment was bringing in an age of reason, rationality, and science. Many Muslims view history from that point in time, 1683, very different. 1683 began an era of several centuries of humiliating defeats at the hands of Christians. This includes the Russian conquest of Central Asia, which had been Muslim, colonialism, European powers taking over large swaths of the Muslim world in the Middle East, North Africa, and Asia. The conquest of the Muslim Balkans by Greece, Bulgaria, and Serbia. And this had been going on for a very long time until in 2001, 9/11 occurred. Now, from a Western perspective, this was a very shocking event. The West had experienced three centuries where religion was not considered to be an important aspect of international politics, and these attacks came out of nowhere. From the perspective of many Muslims, and presumably the people who engaged in the attack, this was just a new twist in a battle that had been going on for centuries. What you believe religiously can very much influence how you perceive what's going on in the political world, and that's how beliefs influence politics.
Yeah, it sets the range of possibilities of policies and of actions that you undertake, essentially helps to set the table for how things operate. And one can understand, too, that if people are envisioning tables in two different ways, there could be a lot of conflict that can result from this.
Yeah, pretty much. This also happens when you have believers of two different religions looking at things different ways, and the clash between the religious and the secular is also one that's very important in just about every country on the planet.
Yeah, that is one that's oftentimes overlooked, too, in a lot of discussions about religion and politics. We only tend to focus on religious institutions, but there are a number of secular activists, secular parties that are really pushing against religion, and that becomes an issue of these worldviews and views that can affect the way that public policy and politics plays out.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Let me go ahead and ask you about the next category here. This issue that you talk quite a bit about is religious legitimacy. What are you talking about there?
Let's talk about legitimacy first. Legitimacy is basically when people believe that you have the right to do something. In the case of governments, if the government has managed to convince its constituents that it has the right to rule, ruling becomes much less expensive. You would need to spend less money on enforcement, less money on perhaps repression. Any parent will really intrinsically understand this. I have an 8-year-old and a 3-year-old. And life is much easier for me if my children believe that they need to do what I tell them to do.
Mm-hmm.
if they go ahead and say, I don't have to do that, why do you don't have the right to make me do anything? Well, it becomes much more difficult for me to get them to behave. The same thing works with governments. The more the constituents believe they must obey the rules set by governments, the more the government is legitimate. And legitimacy comes from all sorts of sources, not just religion. One of the most common and important ones is democracy, which effectively makes people feel that they, since they have a say in choosing the government, they're obligated to obey its rules. But religion is a very classic source of legitimacy. If you can manage to convince a population that God or whatever supreme being or beings you may believe in have given their blessing to the government, this makes people much more likely to obey its rules.
Yeah, and that, there's an interesting pathway that goes to this. And I know a number of my secular colleagues oftentimes have a difficult time imagining how anybody would accept a religious endorsement of a public policy or a government, because they say, I just never think that way. And, you know, in the United States, we typically don't. But still, even in the United States, there's a lot of people that turn to clergy, being that they are trusted officials. You're trusting them with your salvation, with your soul, with, you know, a number of different deep philosophical questions that have important meaning in your life. And, you know, you naturally ask them, hey, I don't know what this whole political thing is about here, if this person is a good person or if that person is a good person, or if this policy is good or if that policy is good. Dear pastor, dear rabbi, dear imam, what do you think about this? And they can wield a great deal of moral authority in that regard and pass that legitimacy on to government, or alternatively, they can delegitimate the government.
Yes, they can. And the reason your secular friends and my secular friends, for that matter, have difficulty understanding that is simply because they're not a member of the club. People who are religious understand how religion influences them, and people who aren't, they actually understand it, but they don't realize it because their belief systems do influence what they consider legitimate. Their problem with religion is simply they themselves don't consider religion legitimate, so they don't understand why anybody would follow it, just as a very religious person might have difficulty understanding why any secular individual would consider various secular beliefs legitimate.
Now, let me ask this about religions getting into that whole legitimacy business. Can that be a dangerous game for them to tread on? Because there's a possibility that if religions start legitimating governments or certain policies that people find over time are very harmful to them, couldn't that really wear off on the religion and people start disbelieving the religion too?
Well, actually, I should probably be asking you that question, because that's the topic you addressed in your first book, Render Unto Caesar,
Rendering Unto Caesar, and I'm glad you mentioned it. Now I can put it in a link in the podcast website, and people can go and buy that book. So
I'm happy to help out with that, but that's precisely the argument you made, as I recall, in Latin America, where the Catholic Church was supporting unpopular governments, and that caused a lot of people to leave Catholicism and join Protestant denominations. So yes, there certainly can be a backlash.
Yeah, and that's one thing I found, especially in Argentina, where the Catholic Church legitimated or favored or supported these two military governments that they had in the latter half of the 20th century. People said, you know, these military regimes were really bad, and the fact that you were legitimating them means that we're not really going to trust you with our soul. If we can't trust you with our basic pocketbook issues and human rights issues, it really stung the Catholic Church. And this has also been an issue that has come up too with the Christian right, and a number of people such as Cal Thomas, who was very instrumental in the 1980s of the rise of the Christian right during that era, has backed off from that. He says, you know what, I don't think churches should get that involved in politics, because if we start supporting candidates that all of a sudden show that they are less than moral in their qualities, that's going to reflect upon our judgment and really hurt our basic religious mission of trying to connect people closer with God.
Yeah, that goes. Liz Fawcett actually wrote an excellent book on this about 20 years ago, where she looked at the churches in South Africa and Northern Ireland, yep, and points out that the churches there, which did take political stances, actually changed their political stances as it became clear the population had changed their political opinions, and they needed to change their political stances to become relevant. In the case of the Dutch Reformed Church, as I think it is in South Africa, they changed from supporting apartheid to opposing it, mm-hmm, because they were not the leaders of that opinion. In this particular case, the tail wagged the dog, and the church changed its position because it was becoming clear that among their own constituents, their own congregants, the apartheid was becoming less popular, and they had to remain relevant.
There's another extreme, too, about this whole religious legitimacy, and this takes us back to the divine right kingships of the 1600s and 1700s in Europe. But even in modern times, there's these certain regimes around the world, and I'm thinking here specifically of Turkmenistan and North Korea, that basically raise their leaders up to levels of deities. Not many people know much about Turkmenistan, but after the collapse of the Soviet Union, they had a guy who came to power, and I can't remember his name right now, but he basically declared himself a deity.
Something like Nemov, something like that?
Yeah, he built...
I'm probably getting the name wrong, so please go to Google.
Yeah, all I can remember, like, it was just one of these really wacky countries where this guy, incredibly poor country, builds this huge gold statue of himself.
I can look up the name.
Yeah, and yeah, he changed the name of the months of the year and everything like this, and pronounced himself a deity. And how much do
he actually wrote a book and required that all study of Islam center around the book that he wrote.
Yeah, that can't sit too well with most practicing clergy in the Muslim world. So, but my question for that, and same thing here in North Korea, which is ostensibly a communist regime that is supposed to be atheistic. You got, you know, the Kim Il-jong rising to a level of a god in many respects with all the worship that comes along. How much do you think a population really buys into that stuff? I know this is not your research area, but I've just always been curious that if I was a regular citizen in Turkmenistan, I saw this gold statue of this guy going up, I'd say, you know, what's going on here, dude?
In the Turkmenistan case, it pretty much fell apart when he died. He died several years ago, and his successor was not particularly interested in continuing the tradition, and it pretty much fell apart, and I don't recall hearing very many people complaining about it.
Yeah.
And if we move over to North Korea, that's a more interesting case because they've managed to keep it going for a while. So I imagine if they manage to keep it going long enough till the point where nobody remembers where when the leader wasn't worshipped, they might get some traction. But I think if you're looking for religious legitimacy, you're better off starting with a religion that people already consider legitimate and then bringing it in to help legitimate the government rather than trying to create your own.
Yeah. And that brings us to your last category that you talk about in your textbook, and that is the issue of religious institutions. And here we're kind of talking about the formal collective representations of various faith traditions. And how do you view this issue here? What role do religious institutions play in that whole religion and politics scheme?
Okay, well, whenever I discuss that issue, I like to start with a quote from Ken Wald, which I really think sums it up. And Ken Wild says that religious institutions are neither designed nor intended to mobilize political action, yet across the globe they seem to have done precisely that.
Mm-hmm.
And when you see religious institutions getting involved in politics, setting aside the issue of maybe them trying to further their political beliefs, the fact is a religious institution has everything you might want if you want to set up a political movement. And I have a whole list of various traits that they have which are useful. They have what I call a public pulpit. They have a public presence. People know who they are. When a member of the clergy who represents a large church gets up and says something, people pay attention. And if you have a political movement, that's something you want. They very often have existing political connections they can use. They don't have to build that from scratch. they have very basic things like a place to meet. You want to have a political movement, it's nice to have some place to meet and organize. They have other organizational resources like, say, offices with computers, internet connections, mailing lists, the Facebook page that people are friends with, all sorts of things like that. They've got money, and they have access to congregants who might have money to donate. They have people with leadership skills, not necessarily just the clergy. Many congregations develop the leadership skills of other members who do other things for the religious organization. If you run the annual bake sale to raise money for your church, you're developing organizational skills when you're doing that. Mm-hmm. You know how to organize people for the bake sale. It's not so hard to apply that to organize people to show up to a protest. They have congregants, which can provide manpower, and they might have all sorts of expertise. You need to put a flyer together. Well, you might have one of your congregants who works for an ad agency. Churches or religious organizations have an inherent level of legitimacy, which means people are more willing to listen to what they have to say. They're also very often able to create a bridging effect, bring people together who might not otherwise be willing to sit in the same room. And they also have a protected status. Governments are less willing to attack or limit a religious organization than they might another political organization. Now, I want to emphasize governments can and do severely limit religious organizations when they engage in politics. This happens all the time, but governments are less willing to do it to religious groups than they are to another political group. When you add all of that together, it's incredibly convenient to organize for a political action using a religious institution, whether or not that action has anything to do with the religion itself. The U.S. civil rights movement in the South was actually a very good example of that. They organized through the churches, even though you could certainly argue that asking for equal rights for everybody is consistent with Christian values, but mm-hmm. It wasn't a particularly religious issue.
Yeah. No, there's been other issues like that in U.S. history. Women's suffrage, a lot of students are surprised.
Oh, yeah, the abolition movement.
The abolitionist movement and that. Yeah. And so a lot of students are surprised to hear that, and including a lot of my colleagues and scholars. And, you've experienced this. Scholars seem to have this blind spot for religion. Scholars focus on these new social movements that have come up. And I'm very quick to remind people who are studying new social movements that if you want to learn anything about these new non-governmental organizations and environmental groups and this group and that group, take a look at the old social institutions that have been doing it for several thousand years. And I remind them how salient religion has been throughout political history. They so oftentimes forget that and just think, we're in the era that religion is no longer going to be important. But I say, Judaism has had a run of 4,500 years and doesn't seem to be going anywhere. The Catholic Church is the longest standing formal institution in the world. And, that's not going anywhere. So I would probably bet that religion is still going to be pretty important in the years to come.
I'm willing to bet most of your colleagues that feel that way are over the age of 40, because I think the younger generation of people coming up, at least in political science, the ones I'm talking to seem to get it more.
I do. I think that they do. And it's in some ways, it's very heartening. In other ways, it's very frustrating, because I've been at conferences at the University of Washington and somebody would be in the room and saying, you really should get somebody on your faculty that studies religion and politics. And I'm sitting right there. And I'm going, it's not a bad idea. Yeah, well, we'll look around for somebody. So, anyways,
we don't have that problem in my department.
Oh, are you chock full with religion and politics, folks?
We have quite a few. Most of them focus on Israeli politics. Mm-hmm. Lots of religion here.
Well, we'll link to that department so people can check out who is all there. I want to conclude this because we're at the end of our time here, and with asking a question about your specific vantage point. As I mentioned at the outset of this interview, you have done an incredible task for social sciences by really tackling this large project of global significance and empirically examining all these different countries that are out there. And so you have a more global view of things that are happening in the world of religion and politics than most people do. In your course of studying this over the past two decades or so, is there been any one thing that has really stood out that you've really learned that you said, wow, I didn't know that before, I changed my mind on that, or one really salient lesson that you like might want to give to our audience here?
Well, there's no one specific thing or event. I mean, just to give you a sense of perspective, the current version of my data has 500,000 data points. That's a lot of information.
Yep.
But when you step back and look at the larger picture, I think the thing that was most shocking to me was that religion is so present in the policy of every state in the world. I grew up in the U.S., and you learn in your civics class about separation, religion, and state, and you really get the impression that religion is not something that should be involved in politics, yet it is, and it's involved everywhere to the extent where I would argue it's nearly impossible for a state government, for a country's government to avoid religion. Governments, they can support it, they can repress it, and most do both, but ignoring it almost never happens. And I found that to be probably the biggest wake-up call of everything I found out.
And I think that, as you mentioned, is true. A lot of people, younger scholars, are really picking up on this nowadays, and maybe some of the older scholars that have been steeped in secularization theory and think religion is going away are also waking up to the fact that religion is ever present throughout history, and it has been ever present throughout the different countries of the world as well. And because of that, our podcast, Research on Religion, will continue on. We're not planning on going anywhere, and we'll bring you many more topics. And it was a joy actually talking to you today, Jonathan Fox, professor at Bar-Ilan University in Israel. Thank you very much for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.